From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, old tensions between Governor Whitmer and state legislative leaders flare during the lame duck session.
You know, both he and the governor usually say things publicly like, my door, our door is open, and that's true, but there is just a lot of bad blood.
We'll get you caught up on what's been happening in Lansing. Then, how one Michigan author's satirical novel turned into an eerie prediction of some of 2020's biggest stories.
On one hand, I was totally floored by it. On the other hand, I thought, well, I guess I was on to something.
Also, healthcare workers stand first in line for COVID-19 vaccines, and yet thousands have chosen not to get them.
When this group is reluctant, that could spell trouble going down the line.
We'll catch you up on all this and more in today's show. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to find out more about the distribution of COVID vaccines in Michigan. A relatively high number of healthcare workers have yet to be vaccinated on the first go-round. More about that coming up, but first, we wanted to catch up on some things that may have passed unnoticed during your holidays. Michigan's legislature met for a lame duck session in December to deal with several critical issues, not least of them, the mass unemployment that's come along with the pandemic. We're going to go over what's passed, what didn't, and some other recent news straight out of Lansing. Joining us today are Lauren Gibbons, politics and policy reporter for MLive, and Zach Gorchow, executive editor and publisher of Gong War Michigan. Zach, Lauren, nice to have you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
One of the biggest things to come out of the lame duck session was a package of criminal justice reforms. Lauren, can you remind us what was in these bills?
These last bills that were signed by the governor dealt primarily with jail and pretrial incarceration, task force results. So there's a whole wide range of reforms that passed, but one of the more significant ones, or at least one of the ones that a lot of people were paying attention to, were dealt with driver's license suspensions. And so the new legislation would decriminalize a number of misdemeanors and traffic offenses. So people wouldn't necessarily be going to jail for driving on a suspended license, for example. However, one significant criminal justice bill that was not signed by the governor was a bill that would allow DUI expungements for the first time offense. That was something that was pushed through during lame duck and had some bipartisan support, but was not included in the package that Governor Whitmer signed.
Lauren, what do we know about the governor's reservations on this one?
Not much. We've asked the governor's office, and you know, she said that she pocket vetoed a number of bills for various reasons, but didn't give many specifics, specifically on the DUI expungement bill.
Zach Gorchow, what are you hearing from advocates for criminal justice reform about how big a difference these reforms will actually make?
I mean, these are huge historic changes. You often hear people in the legislature talk about historic action. Sometimes that's just a fancy word. This whole term, the 2019-20 legislative term, really is one of historic action on criminal justice. And it really is the culmination of two decades worth of work by criminal justice advocates. I mean, these were folks who couldn't even get legislators to take their phone calls or take them seriously in the 90s because the tough on crime mentality was so strong. And now you have bills passing with huge bipartisan majorities. You know, people are going to be able to get long ago criminal offenses that might have been preventing them from getting jobs expunged from their records. I mean, that's very significant. Lauren mentioned, the decriminalization of some of these NIFNAW driving offenses, very, very significant. It's just been quite the cascade of reforms.
The legislature also took action on COVID relief, beating Congress to the punch. Zach Gorchow, could you run us through some of the biggest takeaways that passed in the bill and some of the bigger points of contention?
Well, the biggest takeaway is the veto, I think, is not actually the spending. It's the item that the governor vetoed, and it's this is a real debacle for Governor Whitmer. There's no way to get around it. They screwed up. So the backstory is the negotiations really broke down between the Republican legislature and Governor Whitmer and her staff on a COVID relief supplemental. The Republicans put into the bill a $220 million transfer from the state's sort of main account, the general fund, into the unemployment insurance trust fund, which is what pays for unemployment benefits. The revenues for it come from the state unemployment tax, which is paid for by employers. It's not paid for by general taxpayers.
So far, so good.
The Republicans decided to add this transfer in deference to the business community, which feels like they're going to end up having to pay more in taxes because of high unemployment. The governor decided to veto this. Turns out, by vetoing it, she also nixed what everyone had agreed on would be an extension of the maximum number of unemployment weeks to 26. Usual law in Michigan, at least for the last 10 years, was that you could be on unemployment for a maximum of 20 weeks. For most of the pandemic, it's been 26 weeks. There was a bill that would keep that 26 weeks through March, but it was worded to be contingent on this transfer of $220 million, and apparently the governor and her staff didn't see it, and as a result, anybody who files for unemployment starting January 1 of this year is only eligible for a maximum of 20 weeks. I know that was a mouthful, but that's really the big story.
Lauren, assuming that the top line, assuming that we've covered everything in that top line veto, was there anything else that you noticed about the COVID relief bill?
You know, I think to kind of piggyback off of what Zach was saying, it indicates that there's still quite a bit of tension between Democrats and Republicans on how to move forward, with COVID-19 relief. It's going to continue being a point of contention. The legislature and the governor are required to work together at this point, both from a budgetary perspective and also from, you know, to some extent, a policy perspective, since the governor's state of emergency was overturned back in October. So it's going to continue. I think your word was messy. This is obviously one example of that. There are going to be, you know, several benefits that came out of the supplemental that were a little bit less messy, including, you know, some relief for folks who work in restaurants and entertainment venues and, you know, several areas that have been the hardest hit by COVID-19, you know, that went through without as much of a hitch as some of these unemployment conversations. But I think the whole process itself indicates that it's going to be complicated moving forward to continue having these vital discussions and responding to this pandemic that is far from over.
Zach, Gongwar recently spoke with our Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirkey, about this past year. I mean, it sounded like he also agreed that the friction between the leadership and the governor was something we were going to remember as a defining issue about 2020. Did he give any other hints about whether he thought that that relationship could be repaired over the long term?
Well, you know, both he and the governor usually say things publicly like, our door is open, there's clear examples where they have been able to work together. And that's true. You look at what happened with the budget last year, was clearly an example where the administration and the legislature worked very well together. But there is just a lot of bad blood between the governor and the Senate Majority Leader. And it any time one or the other or both starts digging in on an issue, as we saw with this COVID relief bill, it just seems like the wheels come off and there's just no way for them to find a way to bridge that gap. But these are just two people with totally different worldviews, totally different ideas of how government should work.
Well, to that end, let's talk a little bit about what the next year may hold. We are going to be getting, while Mike Shirkey will still be the Senate Majority Leader, we're getting a new House Speaker in the presence of Jason Wentworth. Do you have any sense, Lauren, about whether priorities might be changing with the changing of the guard?
You know, I think in my conversation with the Speaker-elect, you know, he is interested in ensuring the House plays a greater role in moving forward with COVID-19, which could, you know, again, contribute to some of the complicated conversations that are happening, because the Republicans want a role in this process, and I don't think that's changing. And there's clearly a discrepancy between the administration and the Republicans in the legislature about how to move forward with COVID-19.
Zach Gorchow, what are some of the issues you'll be keeping an eye on over the next few months?
I mean, I think it's largely COVID, COVID, COVID. And how does the new speaker, who has a very, very conservative caucus, how do they move forward? And we don't know a lot about Speaker-elect's style. This is going to be different. We're going to kind of find out on the fly how things are going. Otherwise, I think it's going to be, you know, to what extent does the governor even turn to the legislature for what she wants to do? She made it pretty clear she's going to try to do as much as she can through executive authority, through administrative rules, because there's just, you know, other than criminal justice, it's been hard to find a lot of common ground. But having said that, and pulling it back to criminal justice, the big holdover issue that was not addressed by the legislature is going to be the cash bail system. You know, why should your wealth be the determinant of whether you remain in jail pending trial? That's the biggie that's still out there. We'll be watching that closely.
Zach Gorchow is the executive editor and publisher of Gongmuir, Michigan. We've also been talking with Lauren Gibbons, politics and policy reporter for MLive. Lauren, Zach, great to hear from you. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Still to come on the program, we're going to take a look inside a novel that predicted many of the developments of 2020 in a way that even its author didn't really anticipate. Stay with us. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 2020 is finally and mercifully in the history books. Last year at this time, who could have predicted a pandemic and a militia plan to kidnap the governor? Turns out our next guest did just that with his 2020 novel, The Great American Cheese War. Writer Paul Flower joins us now from his home in Kentwood. Paul, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Paul, did you have the bones of the plot for this book in your mind before the 2020 realities of conspiracy theories and the pandemic hit us?
Well, that's funny you should ask. The bones of this book go back several years. It was long before Governor Whitmer was even a political figure, and no one could have imagined what would come in 2020. So yes, I had this book actually drafted several years ago.
Wow. What was going on in your mind as last year unfolded?
Well, I had written this book about a plot involving a virus that was a dangerous virus and the governor of Michigan, and a conspiracy involving the militia of Michigan that ends up in Wisconsin. And when April came, and suddenly not only did we have this virus, but there were militia guys in the state capitol with automatic weapons surrounding legislators who were debating these coronavirus restrictions the governor had put in place, I kind of went, "Whoa, wait, this sounds kind of familiar." And I was, you know, taken aback. And while on one hand, I was totally floored by it, on the other hand, I thought, well, I guess I was on to something. And then fast forward to this fall when the plot came out involving the Michigan militia and what they wanted to do with the governor, and that it was going to end up in Wisconsin, that didn't end. I was totally floored.
Yeah. We should probably say that the alleged conspirators didn't actually identify as Michigan militia. They were sort of a loosely unaffiliated group that some of whom went by the Wolverine Watchmen. But yeah, I mean, the similarities are just really striking. Early on, you sort of lay out what's going on in the book through a conversation between a guy named Hank, a lifelong Republican from West Michigan, and his best frenemy, Francis. They've been longtime political foils for each other, but they also have a sort of grudging affection. But could you tell us a little bit about Hank's relationship with the truth?
Hank, like many of the characters, several of the characters, is being blown by conspiracy winds. He has a natural leaning to the right politically. He is pretty paranoid about the possibilities that the conspiracy he's heard about in the right-wing media is true. He believes that maybe there's something up in Wisconsin involving cheese recipes, monkeypox, and prairie dogs. And as ludicrous as that sounds, he is really beginning to believe this. And he has gotten sick after being in Wisconsin, and he believes he's been a victim of a monkeypox attack. And so his relationship to what's real and what's true has become pretty tenuous. He's beginning to really believe that the conspiracy is a full-blown event and that he is living it.
Well, there is this moment in the book where he's laying this out to Francis over breakfast at Bob Evans. Would you read for us?
Sure. And to set the stage, Frank is in a moment where he wants Francis to understand what Francis is very skeptical about. "This is what our sources tell us," he says. "Do tell," Francis said in a sarcasm-hued whisper, leaning in. "You have sources." Hank ignored the bait. "About 30 years back," he said, "some forward thinkers in the Wisconsin State Assembly saw the lay of the land in the dairy industry. Competition was killing them. Other states, you know. So they started funneling grants into cheese research. Called it the Cheeses Program." Hank paused to mop his forehead. "Cheeses. See there? That alone. How can you..." "Cheeses." Francis shook her head. Hank plowed ahead. "Thing was, only certain dairy operations with connection to Madison got the grant money from the program. And when the ones that got the money came up with special cheese recipes, only certain powerful dairy guys had access to them. There was no provision in the grants that said they had to share. And we know what happens when we don't share." That's Francis. "A lot of what you call subversive activity is what happened. I mean, you ever heard of the Shawano Six, right?" "Can't say I have." "Of course not. Secret society. Very radical. Disenfranchised. That sort of deal." "Radical cheese guys. Darn straight. Somehow these guys..." "All six of them?" "Yes. From Shawano? Thought you'd never heard of them." "Just guessed." "They got hold of the recipes and started shopping them around the whole country, trying to sell the technology to the highest bidder."
Now, there's more, but I don't want to spoil the enjoyment of folks who might uncover the plot for themselves in the pages of the book. Paul Flower, I guess what Hank is talking about is no weirder than anything else that happened last year, yes?
That's right. And the one thing about this experience for me has been that as a satirist, you're hoping that you take something that's barely plausible and kind of throw it out there and write a funny book that you want people to laugh at. But the implausibility factor is where it gets interesting, because I kept thinking as I wrote the book that I was creating a scenario that was too ridiculous, that maybe people wouldn't find it interesting. And what has happened in the last year in particular, it's apparent that I was pretty close to what reality could produce. And I guess that's the beauty of satire and fiction. You're trying to get to a truth and communicate it in a funny form and sort of address some serious issues in the process.
What's your own relationship with the dueling realities that you write about in the book and that have been playing out in politics over the past years?
Well, my perspective has always been that there are sources of truth in our society, And you cannot trust a particular source or be skeptical about a particular source, but I think we can all agree that there are sources of truth. There are media outlets, there are people that we typically trust. And I've always been that way. There are sources of news and information I've always trusted. But what has distressed me is the realization that we have started drifting into a world where we disavow those sources, where some want to disavow those sources. So what happens is we have people searching for what the truth is, and they're not going to look at it from somebody's perspective if they don't agree with that source. That's a long way of saying we're having a problem deciding what the truth is, and there really is only one truth, and that's the problem. If we can't agree what the truth is, we're in trouble.
Yeah. In your book, The Power Behind the Throne in Michigan is the father of the governor, and he's an appliance magnate who's funding a private army on the side, this paramilitary Silver Eagle. In describing it, I can really feel you drawing on the ethos that has made militias so popular. Could you tell us a little bit about reaction to the militia plot of 2020 that you observed? I mean, you live not very far from where some of the alleged plotters met up.
Thanks for that question. I think it's really interesting. I've grown up and spent my whole life in Southwest and West Michigan, and I know the characters in the book really well because I've lived with them. The plot here happened to have been forged about 15 minutes from my house today. And I think what I've heard is a lot of people laughing at the idea that these guys were in a vacuum cleaner basement plotting to do something with the governor. On the other hand, and this is where the tension between the book and reality exists, is that it's pretty plausible they could have pulled it off. And what I was trying to point out in the book, and I hope I did, is that, yeah, this book's funny, and the plot sort of sounds funny when you talk to people about it. Everybody thinks it's a little ridiculous. Like, what were they going to do? They were going to take her to Wisconsin and hold trial or something. And we kind of say it in that tone. And that's kind of why I wrote the book that was funny about it. It was funny. But the truth is serious and scary, because the truth is there does come a point where young men in this situation, in particular young men in Michigan, fester over these ideas, in this idea that there's a conspiracy about in their midst that they have to fight. When they get down that rabbit hole, the possibility that could happen is very real. And I think when we hear the trial of these men, we're going to find how close to reality it was. And that's scary.
Paul, there was so much that you managed to unwillingly and unwittingly predict. Is there anything that you might have unwittingly thought about that might happen in 2021 that we should be worried about right now?
I keep telling people, I'm trying to write a sequel to this, and I keep telling people, I'm thinking of the good things I can predict. I want to make the Detroit Tigers World Series champs. all of these things I'm going to throw into the book. But I think one of the things we have to be aware of is look around you right now. We have a president who's telling us that the election was stolen from him. No matter what you believe politically, all of the facts say that that's not true. And then we have senators that are arguing, well, a lot of people believe it is true. And the only reason they believe that is because they were lied to. So if anything, what I predict is more of this debate over reality and what's real and what isn't. And when you throw in gun culture and a sense of personal liberty at the expense of the greater good, and a belief that even people who may be trying to save your life from a deadly virus are working against you, if you throw those things into this big stew we have right now, I just feel like the year ahead is going to be better than 2020, because nothing can be worse. And there's a vaccine. We're moving in some positive directions. But all of these things still exist, and they are threats to the way we live and the way we interact. And that concerns me greatly.
Paul Flower is the author of The Great American Cheese War. Paul, thank you so much for your time, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, April.
For decades, researchers have been trying to bring back an iconic fish to Michigan, the Arctic grayling, without success.
But it seems like this time around, we might have a better chance of succeeding than any of the previous efforts.
More than 50 collaborators across Michigan think that they've finally figured out what makes this fish tick. Interlochen Public Radio's Lexi Krupp has more on why, this time, researchers believe they can finally reintroduce the Arctic grayling.
In an out-of-the-way corner of the state fish hatchery in Marquette are a few thousand skinny gray fish. They're skittish.
Movement above them definitely puts stress on them and scares them, so they're kind of in a dark, quiet, three tanks here in a dark, quiet area.
Jim Oho runs the facility for the Department of Natural Resources, and for the past few months, he's been taking care of these fish every day.
They're growing, doing well, very low mortalities, almost non-existent mortalities.
These young, healthy fish are Arctic grayling. They came all the way from Alaska. Nicole Watson went there to collect fish eggs from a river near Fairbanks. She brought them back with her on the plane.
They're my little carry-ons. You get plenty of odd looks from other people on the plane when you are carrying a styrofoam box that says live animals.
Nicole is a fishery scientist at Michigan State University who studies Arctic grayling. The fish hatched in her lab and spent some time in quarantine before they made it to Marquette this fall. And there are a lot of people and money invested in these little fish. That's because there hasn't been a population of grayling in Michigan for more than a century. And that would be shocking to people living here 200 years ago. Back then, the state's rivers were teeming with grayling.
There's records of people just catching them and putting them up on a pile on the bank and just leaving them to rot.
The fish were shipped down to restaurants in Chicago and Detroit, and they were a big draw for tourists because they're easy to catch.
And it wasn't just like going out and catching, you know, 10 to 20 fish. It was going out and catching hundreds of fish repeatedly over and over.
At the same time, in the 1800s, the logging industry was mucking up their habitat, and the state was stocking fish like brown trout, who were suddenly competing with grayling for food. By the early 1900s, there were no grayling left in the Lower Peninsula. The last one was caught in the UP in 1936. And people have been trying to reintroduce these fish in Michigan basically ever since. There was a big push in the 1950s and again in the late 80s, but researchers kept running into the same problem. The fish would just disappear.
They just put them in, and then when they would go out later to look for them, they didn't find them.
Troy Zorn is a fisheries biologist at the DNR. He says since the last big effort to reintroduce grayling in Michigan, researchers have learned a lot about these fish. And in places like Montana, they've tried raising grayling eggs in buckets next to streams, not a hatchery. Right after the fish emerge from their eggs, they swim out a little exit hole. And this method has worked. The grayling came back to the stream as adults to reproduce. And what might be going on here is really cool. Troy says these baby fish could be forming this powerful memory of the water as their home. It's called imprinting.
What they're getting a snapshot of is the scent of the water. So the chemicals in the water and they, the signature of the smell of that water, they somehow lock that away in their brain. You know, it's pretty amazing.
So back at Marquette, all the grayling at the hatchery there, they won't be going into any rivers or streams in Michigan. They're what's called broodstock, the moms and pops. Once they grow up and reproduce, researchers like Troy will put their eggs into streams, where they think the fish have the best shot at survival. Then, hopefully, this next generation of little fish will grow up and return to spawn. That's the plan.
I think there's a decent chance of success, but it's not a sure chance by a long shot.
Even if all goes well, it will be years before any grayling eggs make it into state waters. And then the little fish will have a lot to contend with, like not becoming lunch. But there will be many people rooting for them. And maybe this time, they'll stick around. I'm Lexi Krupp.
You better get those Christmas movie DVDs back to Family Video toot sweet. Like you needed another bit of rough retail news, but here goes. The holdout chain of movie rentals, Family Video, is closing its remaining stores, including locations in Livonia, Farmington Hills, Flint, all the remaining storefronts in Michigan, out of a list that once boasted 70 locations. Some of the stores had tried to stay alive by selling CBD products, but it turns out there just aren't enough Big Lebowski tie-in promotions in the world to make that work. The chain's owner is already selling off all inventory. So we bid a very fond farewell today to Family Video. Following the funerals of Blockbuster and other chains, we will see you in our greasy popcorn dreams. Up next, many Michiganders, including frontline health workers, are showing some hesitation about getting the COVID-19 vaccine.
I am realizing once again that approving the vaccines may have been the easy part. Getting them distributed and people vaccinated seems to be the hard part.
In a minute, we'll hear why and talk to a respected researcher about the science behind the vaccines. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Distribution of the COVID-19 vaccines has begun in Michigan. Dr. Arnold Monto is a leading epidemiologist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, a veteran of many campaigns against infectious disease. He's also acting chair of the FDA's Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. Dr. Monto, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for inviting me.
How are you feeling now after this point at which the COVID vaccine has starting to be administered and people are receiving initial doses?
Well, I'm very happy that the vaccines are available. I am realizing once again that approving the vaccines may have been the easy part. Getting them distributed and people vaccinated seems to be the hard part.
Indeed. Have you taken a dose of the vaccine yet?
I am in group 1B because of my age. I don't see patients directly right now, so I am a little behind the frontline healthcare workers, but I'm planning to get the vaccine in the next couple of weeks, along with my wife.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the mechanisms of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. They make use of an mRNA mechanism, a genetic message to tell the body's immune system what it's up against. Can you explain how that's different from other kinds of vaccines?
Our traditional vaccines deliver the kind of what we call antigen, a protein, which resembles part of the virus, which stimulates the body to respond to that by producing antibodies. The mRNA vaccine takes it back another step, and instead of giving the protein, the messenger RNA is delivered to the body. The body then produces the protein, which is the mechanism for triggering antibody production. The reason it has been chosen is, number one, it's novel and people have been working on it for maybe 15 years, not with a lot of urgency. But the urgency here was that it is a relatively easy, quick way to produce a new vaccine.
There has been a great deal of misinformation spreading about how the vaccines work. I read there was a pharmacist in Wisconsin who was arrested for trying to spoil vaccine doses this week. Police say that he believed the vaccines would change people's DNA in a harmful way. If a friend were to ask you about that fear, what would you tell them?
What I would say is that the mRNA is delivered to the body. It is easily broken down. It doesn't last for very long. It is very specific and codes, as we put it, for the spike protein. So the body is actually producing only the part of the virus that we need to get antibodies produced to. It has nothing to do with changing the DNA. There are DNA vaccines, which are also in development, but this doesn't even contain DNA. It contains RNA because this is an RNA vaccine. So it's the appropriate component to deliver.
Yeah. Do we know anything about potential side effects?
The side effects seem to be very minimal. But what we have to realize is that millions of people are getting vaccinated. The only thing we've seen for sure is that rarely allergic people may develop an anaphylactic reaction. And that's pretty standard, something that we have to watch out for all vaccines.
We've heard some people say that they're waiting to see if there are issues with the vaccine. Do you know if Pfizer and Moderna are working on updating the vaccine or making any changes in the months ahead?
The only thing that has been discussed, and FDA came out yesterday with a strong statement against this, is methods to increase the number of people who can be vaccinated because of the need and the demand, using half doses, waiting for the second dose longer. FDA reiterated what we know just in a statement yesterday, saying, let's go with what we know, and that is the formulation and the spacing of the two doses, which were tested in the Pfizer case in 44,000 people. That's a lot of people for a prime, for what we call a phase three study, and in with Moderna with an excess of 30,000 people.
Do you agree with that course of action?
I do. I think we have to go with what we've got. As a matter of fact, in the U.S. right now, our problem is not number of doses. It's getting the number of doses that are at the various sites in the states out to people. So what we've got to do is make the delivery more efficient. And there are a lot of reasons which that's not my area of expertise, trying to get more doses into arms more quickly. But this is really an important component right now, just getting it out.
Michigan is in phase 1A of the rollout, which, as people might guess from the label, means that those getting the first doses are the front line. Persons in healthcare settings who have that direct exposure to patients or infectious materials, residents of long-term care facilities. What kinds of decisions are being made about the individuals who aren't in hospital settings who may still need to be inoculated?
Well, this really is not my area of expertise. And when we get into these situations, it's hard to make decisions. For example, if you're in a care facility, a nursing home, that's easy because you're there. And a lot of the mortality we've seen has been in these individuals. And that's why they're at the top of the list. Health workers, exactly who is frontline, it's a little harder to determine that. When we get into 1B, where we start having the priority by age, that's relatively easy again, because we know most of the deaths have been in older individuals. I'm a little worried as we get into 1C, where we're dealing with individuals 16 years of age and older with underlying conditions, because defining underlying conditions is awfully hard. And severity of the underlying condition may determine things. So I'm a little worried about that. But if we have enough vaccine and people realize, as they should, that the risk of COVID is far in excess of the risk of any side effects to the vaccine that we know about, then they should get vaccinated. I think most of the people who have seen COVID, the healthcare workers, are really eager to get themselves vaccinated. I think people should look at that and realize that the ones who know how dangerous this disease is. It's not in everybody who's gets infected. In fact, it's in a small percentage of those who get infected. But you can't predict, besides age and underlying conditions, who is likely to get severely ill. Even younger people have wound up in the hospital with on ventilators. So the message is, don't take a chance. Your probability of getting severe disease may be relatively low, but it's still there, and it's still greater than any remote risk associated with getting the vaccine.
Dr. Arnold Monto is an epidemiologist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He'll be taking part in a live presentation this Thursday through the university. Dr. Monto, take care and thank you.
Welcome.
As you heard Dr. Monto say, Michigan is somewhat behind in COVID vaccine administration. Very few states have come close to their targets yet, but Michigan's especially notable. Recent reporting suggests we may be as much as 40% behind the national average. It may be that part of that lag is due to frontline health workers declining to get their COVID vaccinations. Robin Erb has been co-reporting this story for Bridge Michigan, and she joins us now. Robin, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
First off, can you give us a broad picture of where vaccines are being shipped in Michigan, what kinds of places are administering, and maybe who's directing the traffic?
Well, Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, our state health department, of course, is overseeing all of this. But the vaccines right now are being shipped directly to hospitals and to public health departments for distribution or for administration.
I believe it's the case that hospitals and nursing homes and other employers aren't mandating their staff to get vaccinated, but they are strongly encouraging it, aren't they?
That's right. They're strongly encouraging it, but they stopped short of mandating it. Because, you know, for one thing, this vaccine was produced pretty quickly, and there is some hesitation among some employees. So they certainly want to be, it seems to be a little bit of a gray area to mandate it at this point. And frankly, there seemed to be such a push or such a demand for vaccines. I'm not sure they were that worried that people would take them.
So what have you found out about healthcare workers saying no thanks?
It is surprising. We know from surveys last year that there was a hesitancy or a concern or uncertainty among the general public about the vaccine. It was developed quickly. The science tells us that it is safe. The science tells us it's effective. But there was a lot of confusion among the public. What is surprising is the slow uptake among healthcare workers who, you know, you would expect to know a little more about the science, who would trust the science and the health, you know, the studies behind the vaccine development. So I think this has caught a lot of people off guard that healthcare workers are a bit reluctant at this point.
Story says that in Wayne County, just over half of first responders agreed to take a COVID vaccine, which I believe means almost half declined. Not outright refused, but just declined to schedule a vaccination. And that in Ingham County, nearly a third of those who were eligible for it declined. That's higher than providers were expecting?
I think so. Now, it is tough to say exactly how many people are declining, and it may be that some people just haven't scheduled it yet. So, for example, one health system sent out emails to its employees. The fact that those haven't been scheduled could mean that some of those employees haven't taken time to schedule them, or they haven't even opened their email. Remember, a lot of employees may still be on holidays. So did they really refuse to take the vaccine? We can't really say that yet.
What are some reasons that you've heard about why people might be taking a pass?
I think the reasons are varied. There is just general uncertainty. We've heard that. And unfortunately, there is a lot of crazy information out there. There's a lot of distrust of the science. There are just extreme conspiracy theories behind the vaccine, which I certainly don't want to repeat, but it really runs the gamut.
What are the implications for having such a high refusal rate? I mean, for example, let's say we have a nursing home with a staff of 25. What if only, fewer than half a dozen workers decide to get vaccinated?
Right. And that's the most worrisome thing, because when you look at the folks who would get vaccinated, this would be the easiest target. Remember, the state wants to vaccinate 70% of Michiganders 16 years and older. Healthcare workers are in one place, and presumably they would be the first ready to take the vaccine. When this group is reluctant, that could spell trouble going down the line.
If workers do refuse to take the vaccine, is there any path that you're hearing that employers have for deciding who to give it to next?
Sure. You probably heard that the phases for giving out the vaccine, they're pretty detailed. We're still in the very tip top of those phases. We're still at nursing homes and frontline healthcare workers. Then public health departments and others can move down to phase 1B, phase 1C. And then there's another phase and another phase after that before we even hit the general public. And certainly we're hearing from a lot of people who are ready and willing and really want this vaccine. So I don't suspect this vaccine is going to be sitting on shelves for long, but it is worrisome that some of the frontline health workers aren't willing to take it just now.
So it hasn't reached the point where any doses, available doses, have expired, as far as you know?
As far as I know. And that is a concern, because there is a short shelf life for the vaccine. But at this point, what I'm hearing from public health departments is that we'll simply move on to the next, the next phase. Now, there are some limits to that. They can't just jump to the end of the line and ask, those people if they're ready. Again, there is a very careful approach to priority groups, who gets the vaccine next.
You mentioned the fact that these are folks who work at the practical end of a scientific discipline within healthcare. What do you think it says that folks are not exactly jumping at the chance to go and take this tested vaccine?
It would be easy to criticize. But then, remember, just a month ago, not even a month ago, this vaccine wasn't even authorized yet. So things have moved fast. You can argue that the science should be trusted, but I do understand too where people are just kind of lost in all of this. There's an awful lot of information to sort through right now.
Do you know if any of the employers involved or if the state is going to try to do anything to encourage people or maybe change their minds?
There are some campaigns that are planned. I'm told there will be a lot of outreach, especially as we move on to the next groups. The healthcare workers in hospitals and EMS stations and nursing homes, they're easy to reach. But our next phases are going to be, for example, folks who are 75 years and older and maybe living on their own. So that's going to be a tougher group to reach, even to tell them that the vaccine's available. It's also going to be a tougher group perhaps to convince or at least get the information out to them.
Well, how can folks know if there are doses available in their area? I'm sure there are a lot of people hearing this right now who would like to jump in line for that.
One of the main questions that comes up for us from our readers, and I'm sure for your listeners, is when will I know when I can get the vaccine? And what we're hearing right now is that, the public health departments, your doctors, even the person who delivers your mobile meals, you'll hear that way, which is kind of frustrating, because right now it's don't call us, we'll call you. But we are being told right now that that word will get out when you're eligible for the vaccine, you will hear about it.
Robin Erb covers healthcare for Bridge Michigan. Robin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, April.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. And we'd like to welcome the newest member of the team today, Erin Allen, who is the newest producer joining the show. We're so happy she's here. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.